technical difficulties. We'll be back.
Tuned to 102.7 FM, Vancouver's only independent, commercial-free radio station. Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly program that focuses on animal issues in the hope of increasing awareness and compassion for non-human species. Animal Voices is being preempted next Friday, so that this is our final show before Christmas Day. There are just two of us in the program today, John Pranger, who is a member of Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, and myself, Marge Adams. Our other two members are vacationing down south. And I am the member of Vancouver Humane Society. The program is made possible through the cooperation of those three local associations, but the views expressed on the shows are not necessarily those of the organization. In this hour, we'll be talking about no-kill animal shelters, companion animals in the holiday season, cruelty inflicted on egg-laying hens in Canada, animal experimentation, and we'll be having various other animal issues, news issues. We're relying on John Pranger to be our technician, and he will be telling us some stories and reading news items. So let us turn to our first item today, which is the egg-laying hens. This is an item in the Vancouver Humane Society newsletter, which is called Animal Rights. And this particular item is about shocking truths about eggs. And it's been a revelation to a lot of people in Canada just over the last little while, because there was an undercover photographer who secretly took pictures and video footage of an Ontario battery farm. The pictures caused a media sensation in October, when the Coalition for Farm Animals, of which VHS, Vancouver Humane Society, is a member, held a media conference in Toronto to release the graphic footage. And this is the first time such footage has been made available to the public, and it was shocking indictment of the egg industry. Vancouver Humane Society Executive Director Deborah Probert wrote this article, which is quite a graphic one itself. It has pictures of the conditions of the hens in their overcrowded, terribly overcrowded cages, and the fact that their feathers are many of them are naked, have naked necks because they have to stretch through the cages in order to get to their food. The feathers are all rubbed off, and not only on the necks, but other parts. So that the footage was obtained by an activist who entered the farm under cover of night. It shows egregious cruelty, which, although probably not surprising to anyone in the industry, is shocking to any kind human being, and shows that, contrary to industry claims, the situation for factory-farmed animals in Canada is no different than the horrible cruelty that is being uncovered in the United States. CCFA, which is the Coalition for Farm Animals, message at the media conference was clear. Eating eggs in Canada means supporting cruelty that would be persecutable if it were being perpetrated against animals with more legal protection, namely dogs and cats. So a person could actually be prosecuted for this kind of action against our pet animals. Farm animals in Canada have no legal protection. There is no oversight of farm conditions, no legislation protecting animals on farms. The conference also released a report prepared by Bruce Passmore, who is a member and employee of the Vancouver Humane Society, entitled Battery Cages and the Welfare of Hens in Canada, a summary of the scientific literature. The report provides indisputable evidence that battery hens are not only inappropriately caged, but seriously compromised. These cages seriously compromise the welfare of the hens. The farm in question has links to the University of Guelph, and ironically, the farm's owner, Lloyd Webber, is a veterinarian who, at the time of writing, was organizing a poultry welfare conference in Ontario. The university has a well-respected animal welfare department, and it's difficult not to speculate that if this farm, with such esteemed connections, is so bad, what are other farms across Canada like? We have no reason to believe that this is not the norm. Industry will be eager to defend itself, of course. They probably won't make any effort to point out that the codes, and they will refer no doubt to these codes of conduct, but they are recommended and therefore voluntary. They are not enforced. Responding to increasing criticism regarding animal welfare recently, the egg industry has been particularly vocal in its own defense. It says it is in a unique position to oversee welfare because the Egg Marketing Board oversees the quota system. This means that farms are visited periodically to assess the number of birds, since each farmer has a quota that he must abide by. However, it's obvious that this farm, which has a quota, that oversight by the agency is for quota purposes only. The cruelty has apparently been either overlooked or disregarded because it is of the industry standard. So it's a pretty sad situation for these hens who are so badly beaten up. Vancouver Humane Society has been working hard on this issue for some time now. I guess it's getting about a year that the coalition has been working together with three groups across Canada, at least. Winnipeg, Toronto, and Vancouver are allied to try and help improve things for the hens. And Vancouver Humane Society is having a demonstration this Saturday, December the 17th, at 12 noon, at a Super Value store on Davie Street. The reason for this demonstration is because Loblaws, which is the owner of Super Value, has been asked to label their eggs as battery hen. Eggs from battery hens, and they have not been willing to do this as yet, so that the hope is that by presenting the Safeway, the Super Value, with a stocking of coal for Christmas, that will give the message to the Super Value that the chickens especially are not satisfied, because the presentation will be made by Henny, who is the mascot for Vancouver Humane Society. She's a 6-foot-tall hen, very badly beaten up from her years in the battery cage. And she is going to be presenting this stocking of coal, and hopefully that'll get the message across that we want people to be informed about what they are buying. Today it's not necessary to put on the packages of eggs where they come from, so that if they were labeled from caged hens, people would then at least know what they're buying. Just a reminder, if you want to make things better for hens, look for certified organic eggs. Those are the only ones that are actually audited for welfare standards. There are many other labels used, like free run, free-ranged, or euphemisms like Omega, natural, farm fresh, fed vegetarian feed, healthy or enriched, etc. But these are not, these are really just euphemisms, according to Deborah Probert's article. They do not tell us anything that is really audited or inspected regarding the hens. So look for certified organic if you're going to be buying eggs. Now, John, back to you.
Okay, thanks, Marge. Let's have a little story, eh? And this is called The Dumpster Kitty in the Hand of God, and it's written by Frank L. Hoffman. And this is a true story that happened early this morning, but it really began this past Friday. Every Tuesday and Friday, I fly our plane to a regional medical center where we are assisting them with several projects. After I flew back on Friday, I had to drive to the office to drop off some papers and pick up some others I needed to work on over the weekend. I put my briefcase on the small conference table in my office and took out several folders and took out the papers and filing, picked up the new papers and put everything back into my briefcase, or at least I thought I had, for I don't remember seeing anything left on the table. Well, when I got home and started to write up some of the minutes of the day's events, one of my folders was missing. So I debriefed myself as much as I could from memory, and Monday morning I called the office and asked one of our administrative assistants to review my notes with me, thus saving myself an extra trip to the office. After all, I am supposed to be semi-retired. This morning, I got up at 4 o'clock, so I would be able to stop at the office and pick up this folder and some other material before going to the airport. It was still dark when I got to the office, with just a faint glow showing in the sky. As I got out of my car, two wild kittens ran up to me, or cats. This is very unusual, so I started to talk to them, but they wouldn't let me get close enough for me to touch them. As I went to throw a bag of trash in the dumpster, they ran after me. I flipped the bag into the dumpster, and the two kitties started meowing. I continued to talk to them and to try to reach out to them, but they would run off a short distance. But as soon as I would begin to turn away, they would run ahead of me. Then one of the kittens ran past me and jumped up on the rim of the dumpster. It was then that I heard a scratching noise coming from the dumpster. I walked over and looked in. As the kitten on the rim jumped off, I couldn't see anything. Then some movement caught my eye. This little black kitten in the darkness of the dumpster was jumping up the side and trying to climb out, but every time he or she slipped back down into the bottom. The dumpster was too deep for me to reach into the bottom, so I went into our building and found a piece of wood about 6 feet long. I put it into the dumpster and leaned it against the side to make a ramp. The kitty jumped on the wood and climbed out, jumping away from me to the ground, and ran away. When I turned around and the other two kittens were running off after the little black one. So I turned and went into the office, picked up my folder and other papers, put them into my briefcase. I then filed my flight plan over the phone and left the office. As I left the office, there before me were four kitties waiting for me, I believe, to say thank you. No one could ever convince me that these kittens weren't thinking and planning what to do to save their sibling. The very way they acted is proof of the characteristics of what we call soul and spirit. If I hadn't helped that kitten out of the dumpster when I did, it could have been crushed or trapped under the morning trash. I still can't believe I didn't see that folder on the table, for it was empty when I got there, except for what I had to pick up, and I believe it was completely empty when I left. Thus, I believe the Lord knew that I would be attentive to these kittens early today, and that I would have to be there way before the others arrived and before the trash began to fill the dumpster. So he arranged for me to be there. The hand of God reaches out to touch us all, but I believe most people don't recognize his touch or call to service, even if it's only to rescue a little black kitty from a deep, dark dumpster. Let's pray that we are all more attentive to his touch. Amen.
con hambre, pierna de sol, brazos de alambre negro en camisa, tuberculosis, color ceniza, color ceniza. Negro en su casa, cama de suelo, fogón sin brisa, qué cosa, cosa, más triste, triste, más lastimosa, suena guitarra de Barlovento, que lo que diga lo lleva el viento, suena guitarra de Barlovento, que lo que diga lo lleva el viento.
Thank you, John, for the story and for that lovely music. Now I want to talk a little bit about shelters. Some of them are shelters that euthanize animals, and some of our shelters are no-kill. Well, today we're going to concentrate on the no-kill shelters. The problem is the definition of the term no-kill varies. Some people will call it no kill if the shelter sorts out the animals and says these are placeable animals and these ones are not. Perhaps they're sickly or maybe they're vicious or something else, so that all of those animals that cannot be brought back to a good standard of living and perhaps would be dangerous to people, well, they will be killed. The others will be no-kill, so that they refer to this as a no-kill shelter at times, at any rate. But there are other shelters that are actually no-kill and other organizations that practice a no-kill policy. And those are the ones, particularly, I would like to start with one that rescues large animals and small, and that is one called Big Julie's Rescue Ranch, which is in Fort McLeod, Alberta. The person who runs the shelter is Roger Brinker, a man we have had on our show a few times, a delightful person who is able to tell a good story. Now, Roger's newsletter came out the other day, and that's what got me thinking that would be worth telling you something about Roger's shelter or refuge, is Big Julie's Rescue Ranch. And he has very strong opinions about animals and that their lives are valuable. He thinks all lives are valuable, and that he is certainly not one who is going to kill any animal that comes to him who can be, live comfortably. And once he has it in his shelter, it stays and it is looked after well. Now, this is an excerpt from one of his newsletters. As so many things here do, it started with a phone call. A man claimed to have saved a foal from being neglected, but had to go on a trip and had no one to care for the animal. If it was all right, he would bring her the next morning. I directed his trailer to the gate. Unnecessary. She was so small and so light that he carried her. Her legs were so weak that any attempt to walk had her shaking violently. At that, she was standing on her knuckles, not her hooves. I have, of course, no idea how much of the story he told was true, but here it is. She was 2 or 3 months old, a definite lie, days or at most a couple of weeks. She was born in a neighbor's property, abandoned by her mother, and her owner had done nothing to help her. He had rescued her from that fate, but had no milk to feed her. Roger says, I gave her water, though. I'm sorry. The person who brought her in said, I gave her water, though. After 3 days of that neglect, he phoned the RCMP and asked the attending officer to shoot her. The constable refused and suggested he find a home for her. I phoned around everywhere. Nobody would take her. Then I thought of you, brilliant. He had considered retiring one of his horses to the rescue ranch years earlier, but here, with an animal in distress, he couldn't think of it. When I need to bottle feed an animal, I get milk from the Hutterite colony. It has to be picked up at milking time around 4 in the afternoon. My sweet little horse arrived at mid-morning. After all that neglect, I was not having her wait until afternoon for food, but hurried to warm some of my own milk and fill a bottle. My first attempt at feeding gave me a hint why she had been abandoned by the mare. She could not or would not open her mouth wide enough even to take in the rubber nipple of the bottle. It would end up between her cheek and gum, milk going everywhere on the ground, over her, over me. But I was glad to see she was swallowing greedily that which ended up in her mouth. Back to warm milk, this time offered in an ice cream bucket, and with me holding up her head, she happily drank it. What happened at the next feeding makes her loss almost unbearable. She lifted her head when she saw me coming and greeted me with the softest whinny, which I answered in kind. From then on, each feeding would begin with our friendly greeting. Coming to think of it, I must have been the first creature of any kind, man or animal, who showed her any kindness and had lifted her spirits. It was a sheer joy to be with her at every feeding, spread an hour and a half to 2 hours apart. Fortunately, it was summer. All the animals were grazing in the pasture, and I could devote all my time to sweet soul. For 2 days she held her own, feeding well, all bodily functions normal. On the third day, I found her in a depression, unable to get up. I gently pulled her to the level ground and fed her. An hour later, she had moved and lay in another bad spot. Again, I pulled her out and realized, to my horror, that she had become unconscious. I stayed with her for the next 2 hours, helplessly watching as her breathing became shallower. When it stopped, I put my ear to her chest, hearing a strong, steady heartbeat. So for the next half hour, I was her breathing. By compressing her chest with both hands, I could duplicate the short breath she could no longer manage on her own. I would pause now and then to listen to the beating of her heart, which was calmly beating on until the second last check, when it was termed erratic, and the last when it had gone. So that was a terrible blow to Roger. He buried her in the pasture. Roger strongly defends the right to life of every creature. He says, the founder of one animal welfare group advised his followers not to waste their money by supporting rescue ranch. Their aim must be to campaign for all animals, not concentrate on rescuing a few. Just my paranoid imagination? No. One of his followers told me. She decided to find out for herself. Saw a huge steer walk up to me and lick my hand and thought, rescue ranch, it's worth supporting. 10 years later, she is still with us, and so is Arcanus, the big steer. Another organization known worldwide and with a budget last year of over $17 million U.S., once sent me a 10-page letter making the point that unwanted animals were better off dead than living in no-kill shelters. I fired back a letter that would blister paint. I can believe it. Received another in return, which basically said, shh, let's not concentrate on our differences. We are, after all, fighting for the same cause. Roger says, no, we are not, when in order to concentrate on the big picture, they are willing to sacrifice individuals. And that he would never do. Roger accuses these organizations of considering that animals are no better than merchandise, and that really bothers him. Sometimes when I'm asking myself if I am doing the right thing, that is what reassures me. When animals come to me, they cease being merchandise. There is no change of mind or circumstance that will impact their future. They are safe for life. Roger is a very, very compassionate man, and he tells these wonderful stories in his newsletters, which come out maybe 3 or 4 times a year. It depends on the time he has. Unfortunately, he has a very severe hip problem and does not move about easily, so the work is very hard for him, and sometimes he does not have an assistant, which makes it extremely difficult. So Roger Brinker is no Big Julie's Rescue Ranch. It's certainly a no-kill shelter for animals. Now, before we go on to the second example of a no-kill organization, I'd like to ask John to play us a little bit of music. FM on your radio dial, Vancouver's Co-op Radio. Now we're back to Animal Voices, and the second example of a no-kill organization, this is a local one, headquartered in North Vancouver, and it's called Animal Advocates Society of British Columbia. This is an organization that does a lot of rescuing in the Lower Mainland area particularly, and they put out a publication called The Guardian. I always enjoy receiving this publication because it tells about rescues that they have done and a whole lot more, but I like the rescue stories. They have happy endings. This one is called The Saving of Tuk-Tuk, the Market Dog. For 6 years, from the time she was a few months old, Tuk-Tuk spent her days in a pen behind a grocery store, her bed a cardboard box. At night, she lived in the back of the store. She never walked, was never walked or patted or talked to, except by some of the store's customers who begged for years to be given her or be allowed to buy her. She was never spayed, and it was said that sometimes puppies were sold along with cigarettes, pop, and chips. When she was visited, she never barked, but sometimes she jumped up against the chain link and stared, hope in her beautiful yellow eyes, and sometimes she would not raise her head. Tuk-Tuk's luck had been bad since the day someone sold her to the store's owners as a wee pup, and it looked like she was going to endure and then die in the pen behind the store. This went on year after year, with more and more shoppers talking in the parking lot about what to do about Tuk-Tuk. Offers to buy were refused, plans were made, and then fell through. Then, one day, Tuk-Tuk at last got lucky. Her whole life changed so suddenly that she almost went mad with happiness. She pranced and smiled and kissed and frolicked, and there was no sleep for anyone that night. Tuk-Tuk was bouncing off the walls, and her yellow eyes sparkled with disbelief and with the joy that fills the heart of every happy dog. 6 years of loneliness was over. For every rescue, the bills... Like every rescue, the bills for Tuk-Tuk started to mount up. Years of neglect, ears and skin had to be made better. Her uterus became infected, and she quickly became very ill and had to have emergency surgery. Cancer appeared in an eyelid, more surgery. In all, over $900 was spent on Tuk-Tuk's vet bills and even more on foster care. But hearing how happy she is, how she runs in the woods and at the park, how she has learned to have fun with other dogs and to sleep beside the bed of her loved ones makes the bills insignificant. Isn't that wonderful? I think it's so, we're so fortunate to have an organization that is willing to get out there and really do for these needy creatures. Here's one other story, a much shorter one, and this one is about a cat. Rescue groups work together like a well-oiled machine. This is encouraging, too, to think of these groups actually assisting one another in different areas. Recently, a volunteer from Animal Advocates Society was asked to rescue a dirty, unneutered cat with a case of badly infected ears from ear mites. The cat had no owner and lived on rural property in Abbotsford, and although slightly feral, had shown a willingness to interact with humans. The Animal Advocates Society volunteer immediately took him to a veterinary clinic, Pets in Need Society, paid for his neutering and shots. Animal Advocates Society paid for his ear medication. Pacific Animal Foundation paid his veterinary boarding costs for 1 week. And Animal Orphan Kitten Rescue Association found a new home for him. Yesterday, the AAS, that's Animal Advocates Society, volunteer drove Scout to his new home in Southlands, where he will have another cat for company. Freedom of a farm life, and be allowed to come inside the house whenever he wants. The fact that many groups work together like a well-oiled machine isn't a surprise to most of us in the volunteer cat rescue community in the Lower Mainland. But by sharing this particular rescue effort with the public, it highlights what can be done through cooperation when a determined effort is made to improve the life of an animal. Many volunteer groups participate every day in similar rescue efforts, and the common philosophy that binds us is work for the benefit of the animal. By incredible networking through the internet and phone calls, various groups routinely coordinate and cooperate to facilitate some challenging rescues. The resulting goodwill and respect through this kind of teamwork has meant that many animals are benefiting. A little semi-feral cat called Scout can attest to that. And there's a little picture of him, black and white, beautiful little creature. Very encouraging to hear these stories about what is going on right in our own backyard to help animals. So often we hear of the unhappy side of things. So now we'll go back to John.
Thank you, Marge. And... let's talk a little bit about animal vivisection and cancer, our modern-day plague. Did you know that of 20 compounds known not to cause cancer in humans, 19 caused cancer in animals? On the other hand, of 19 compounds known to cause oral cancer in humans, only 7 cause cancer in mice and rats using the standard National Cancer Institute protocol. For example, the industrial chemical benzene causes cancer in humans, but not in mice. So science editor Philip Abelson has asked, are humans to be regarded as behaving biochemically like huge, obese, inbred, cancer-prone rodents? Well, yes, if weighing the standard cancer research protocol. Careless conclusions that overlook or ignore crucial distinctions between species are the backbone of animal experimentation. At first glance, we find that mice are highly susceptible to tumors of the mammary glands, of the liver, the pituitary gland, the thyroid, and the lung, and lymph systems. This suggests their suitability for studies of those cancers in humans and has, of course, been used to justify mouse experimentation. However, close scrutiny of these tumors reveals huge discrepancies between human and murine or mouse variations. Even though they are located in the same region, they are not the same cancers. Plus, the natural incidence of these cancers in mice is so high that it is difficult, if not impossible, to determine if a chemical given to induce cancer caused the tumor or if the tumor was spontaneous. Naturally occurring cancers are called spontaneous cancers. In a specific instance, one research group concluded that the use of mice and dieldrin-aldrin, a cancer-inducing chemicals, to study liver cancer was not indicative of human risk. Some common human tumors, such as prostate, colon, and rectal cancer, are rare in rodents. Marge, would you pick that up? David Rose of the American Health Foundation stated, indeed, there continues to be a lack of a universally accepted animal model for the human disease prostate cancer. And so researchers have to toil long to inflict prostate, colon, and rectal cancer on their lab animals. And when these cancers are forced upon rodents by induction, they are deviant, behaving very differently from the way they do in humans. Note this. Rat colon tumors kill by obstructing the colon. Human colon cancer cells, human colon cancer kills by metastasizing to other places in the body. That means it removes itself to other places in the body and then starts up again as new tumors. The tumors of the rat bowel do not usually spread. In rats, it is most often the small bowel that is affected. In humans, it's the large bowel or colon. But despite these dramatic differences between species, we call both diseases colon cancer and proceed with millions of dollars worth of tests on rodents to obtain information that cannot be extrapolated to humans. Is the cancer the same cancer no matter where and which and in which species? No. Intuitively, one would suspect that mice and rats, as tiny quadrupeds with big round ears and long tails, would share more similarities than either species shares with people. Yet, chillingly, rats and mice cannot agree on their cancers either, making the effort to mime human medicine in rodents even more of a folly. Studies conducted on mice and rats found that 46% of chemicals found to be cancer-causing in rats were not cancer-causing in mice. That's 46%. Furthermore, mice do produce tumors in response to chemicals that do not cause cancer in rats. Liver tumors, for example, can be induced via chemicals in mice, but the same chemicals will not induce cancer in rats or hamsters. In one test, rats and mice gave the same results at most only 70% of the time. Another study has revealed that only 54% of chemicals found to be carcinogenic in one species were carcinogenic in the other. Differences also exist between sexes. Of 33 chemicals that cause cancer in both rats and mice, only 13 cause cancer in both males and females. These sorts of tests cost upwards of $250 million annually in the United States. Take a syringe and inject almost any chemical into humans, then into different rodents, and you will get widely varied results. There's a gulf of discrepancy between species. Benzedrine, for example, causes bladder tumor in humans, liver tumors in rats, and acoustic middle ear tumors in rats. Another cancer researcher resolved that it is painfully clear that carcinogenesis in the mouse cannot now be predicted from positive data obtained from the rat, and vice versa. Yet one more naysayer stated that, as a researcher, I am involved with mutagenesis and carcinogenesis, two areas in which experimentation is fundamentally indispensable. I therefore know what I'm talking about, and I say no to vivisection, animal experimentation, above all, on scientific grounds. It has been proved that the results of research with animals are in no case valid for man. There is a law of nature in relation to metabolism, according to which a biochemical reaction that one has established in one species only applies to that species and not to any other. Two closely related species, like the mouse and rat, often react entirely differently, unquote. The bottom line is, again, this. Rodents are not small, furry humans. Scientists who conduct cancer experiments on mice and rats have concluded that the lifetime feeding study in mice and rats appears to have less than a 50% probability of finding known human carcinogens. We would have been better off to toss a coin. Better off in terms of evidence gathering, perhaps, but not in terms of funding labs and scientists and curing disease. As historical ledgers indicate, getting paid to toss coins has been remarkably good business during the cancer offensive. Do we really want to foot the bill for extravagant speculation at human expense? This crapshoot is the reality of our national cancer inquiry.
Thank you.
You're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, and this is Animal Voices.
Oh, thank you, John. Here's something on a little lighter note. Little Harold was practicing the violin in the living room while his father was trying to read in the den. The family dog was lying in the den, and as the screeching sounds of Little Harold's violin reached his ears, he began to howl loudly. The father listened to the dog and the violin as long as he could. Then he jumped up, slammed his paper on the floor, and yelled above the noise, "For Pete's sake, can't you play something the dog doesn't know?" I love that. I have another story for you. This one is once again from Big Julie's Rescue Ranch, and the author is Roger Brinker, who's the owner-operator of the Rescue Ranch, that has more than 80 animals, rescued animals, on it at this time. Now, when Roger started on the Rescue Ranch 16 years ago, he only cared for dogs, and the original number was 20, which soon increased to 30, and then over 40. He says, "When I began to care for the cattle and horses, I decided to reduce the number of dogs. Reduce is easier said than done, when all animals are entitled to live out their lives here. And, of course, I would still not turn away any dog who is in one way or another at my doorstep in distress. Still, old dogs reach the ends of their lives, and so, after various ups and downs in numbers, I have arrived at a count of 17 dogs. This was last fall, when an unfamiliar car drove into the yard. 'We have a dog for you,' announced the driver gruffly. I was about to tell him that he could do with his plan of dumping his dog on me, when I recognized the woman in the back seat holding a frightened animal by a thick rope, gray with age. She had years earlier delivered a long lecture to me on how my saving and caring for animals was all wrong. Animals were supposed to die. And to underscore the point, she proudly related that, although they lived beside a busy highway, their children's pets were not protected from running into traffic. But now, when they wanted to rid themselves of a dog, my attitude towards dogs was suddenly useful to them. Contemptuously thinking the dog lucky that they were taking him to this rescue ranch instead of just shoving him out in traffic, but still not wanting her, I also knew that those frightened eyes would haunt me to the end of the days. I took her in. As she was a healthy, young, intact female, I made arrangements with the vet to have her spayed the following week. She came into heat that weekend, and two eager males got to her. By the way, her name is Stumpy because of the stumpy little tail that she has, which kind of jarred Roger when he first saw it, because he thought, what idiot would dock the tail of a shepherd-type dog? But there you have it. Anyway, Roger, not wanting to have the dog spayed after she was pregnant, prepared the laundry room as a nursery. So when Stumpy stood with her back strangely arched, crying out in pain, I quickly led her to her room and stayed in the capacity of midwife, mid-husband. Although it was clearly her first litter, she was a marvel of motherly competence. She removed the membrane from the first little sausage and vigorously licked it dry. I do not know if nature inserts automatic intervals between births to provide time to care for each puppy individually, or if mother controls the process and only allows another to slip out when she is satisfied she has had time for the next arrival. I intervened only once with number 3 when I thought she was a bit slow removing the membrane from the head. It was about this time that I learned who the idiot was who docked Stumpy's tail, Mother Nature. There between the legs, dragged out behind this tiny pup, was a stump for a tail. The stumps ran in the family. It was nearly dawn by the time Stumpy and I were settled on fresh, clean bedding, she lying on her side, 5 identical sausages attached to Mum, energetically sucking. I happily staggered off to bed and slept soundly for a few hours. First thing upon awakening was, of course, a trip to the nursery. There was Stumpy looking up at me from 6 puppies. She had quietly added one more all by herself. Stumpy was a wonderful, caring mother, spending time away from her babies only when absolutely necessary for the first 10 days. Then a disaster of very heavy severity struck Stumpy. She had at last taken time for herself and was standing next to the fence that divides the yard, separating dogs who do not get along. While she was preoccupied with dogs on her side, the hostile one from the other side managed to push his nose past a loose board and sank his teeth into her flank. As he held on and she tried to free herself, she ripped and ripped her own hide to shreds. Finally free, she came running inside, panting in panic. It was a horrendous wound, extending from her spine all the way to her belly and down the back leg, flaps of skin hanging everywhere. The wound opened wide with every movement of the leg to a size larger than my outspread hand. As it was near closing time at the clinic, I screamed into the phone not to leave. I would be there with a badly injured dog. A veterinarian sees many injuries and takes them in stride, but this horror had her step back in consternation. There were two concerns. One, how to treat the injury. Two, how to keep the puppies alive. There were skeptic, pained expression every time I mentioned the age of the pups. At 10 days old, some still blind, they need the care of their mother. We collected all the equipment needed, tiny bottles, canine milk replacer, and I returned home to try to replace Mum. Meanwhile, at the clinic, the head vet had been called and the decision made to close the wound temporarily with gauze and consult a specialist in the morning. Back at home, I prepared tiny bottles and attempted to feed the babies. They were having none of it. Normally, while nursing, each baby is surrounded by brothers and sisters and being licked and nuzzled by Mum's friendly and face. I had to hold them individually, trying to persuade them to accept the flimsy nipple, which in their opinion was nothing like Mum's. I got food to them at a discouraging slow pace. Time and again, I would have to reheat the milk and try again, and that multiplied by six. And so it went. But finally, he was able to get the puppies fed. And, of course, he had to get out to the other 80 animals that were needing care over the winter. So he was on the phone to the clinic as soon as it opened. "I'm bringing the pups," boldly spoken. "But would it work? While Stumpy was holding her own, she might be too stressed to accept and care for her babies. In case the shock might have dried her up, but we had to make the attempt." So he's going to save these puppies by getting them back to their mum. The mode of transportation was a gym bag lined with fluffy towels. Stumpy walked over slowly. It must have been so painful, and settled down with her babies as soon as they were unloaded. What an exemplary mother she was. The vets had their own concerns about their effectiveness in treating this dog, which they were not used to doing. It was a more difficult operation than they had done in the past. So what happened was Stumpy had to be taken to a specialist, and the specialist operated. He was quite successful in doing that. It took him a day or two to assess the situation. Then he operated, and finally, I'm hurrying because we're running out of time, but the dogs were discharged, and that meant they went back to the original clinic so that the next day Roger picked up what he called the ugliest dog you ever saw. Her entire left side had been shaved, including the hind leg, and most of it looked like a crazy quilt with all the suture lines running here and there. So the little ones had to stay at the clinic for another week or so, but they eventually did get home. And when the last drain was pulled from the mother, that's when they went back to the nursery. As the weeks went by, Stumpy's fur began to grow back, and the pups were allowed occasional sojourns into the rest of the house and began eating solid food. The staff at the clinic offered help in finding homes for the pups. Cute as they were, they would be gone in no time, they thought. They do not understand the joy of seeing the exceptional devotion of a mother dog once she has overcome a crisis of losing her babies. And then he tells a very brief story about a St. Bernard mother and her litter of pups that had been separated for a number of years, and they were reunited at Roger's Rescue Ranch, and they lived together as a team for years with him. Finally, the mother died at age 13, and that kind of broke up the group a bit. But Stumpy and the gang are such a group as this St. Bernard and her puppies, now 10 months old, more or less her size, as the St. Bernard, and the pups, they're all pretty much the same size. I often see her leading them single file in search of adventure, only to break into a galloping mob, tongues lolling, ears flapping, when Stumpy has spotted something of interest. Their entire lives are bubbling over with enthusiasm and irresponsibility. Stumpy, I stand in awe and feel privileged of knowing a creature of such character. So all that excitement is just part of Roger's regular life, and he is so totally, totally devoted to those animals. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful situation for any animal to get into with Roger Brinker at Big Julie's Rescue Ranch in Fort McLeod, Alberta. So I think we're out of time right now. Thank you for listening. We will not be on next week, but please join us again in 2 weeks' time for Animal Voice.